Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, today my guest is Mark Sidwell, author of the book, The Long March, How the Left Won the Culture War and What to Do About It. It's published by the New Culture Forum this year in 2020. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Kirk. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, I'm glad to have you here. Congratulations on the publication of your book.
Thank you.
And it's gotten some great reviews and previews as well. One thing I noticed on your website, let me start with this then. It looks like the book is available for free. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's an ebook on Amazon for anyone who can afford it. I'd certainly be very grateful for that as a poor author. But yes, we've also made a PDF available on the website of the New Culture Forum because we wanted these ideas to be out there. They're a small outfit. They're very interested in, you know, spreading ideas and getting new thought to people. So they wanted to have that option as well. But it's a PDF, so it's not quite so easy to read as an ebook. There is, in fact, a hardback as well, but it's mostly for people in the UK. It could be shipped elsewhere in the world, but you'd have to be very, very keen on the book for that indeed.
Right. Okay. Oh, that's great. But it sounds rather left wing of you, unfree market capitalist.
Maybe we're trying to learn from people who are better at these things than us. And you know, that's part of the point of the book, perhaps, is that people on the free market right, which is, I guess, where I broadly come from, have been very, very good at winning economic arguments and thinking in those capitalistic terms and understanding profit incentives and all of that, and maybe less good about spreading ideas in a sort of cultural way. And that's something that the other side has been perhaps better at. So maybe we need to steal a few ideas across.
Very good. Oh, wow. I'll steal this book. It's like another yippee idea going back. But before we get into the discussion of the meat of your book, could you please tell our audience a bit more about yourself, and particularly as it relates to the subject of the book?
Sure. So my background is journalism in the UK. I've been working as a business and finance journalist for the last 10 years or so. Most recently, I've been running personal finance coverage for The Telegraph in London. And before that, I also worked in free market think tanks on the free market right, as I say. And both of those worlds are very economically focused. They're all about places where you think about, you know, what's going wrong economically and how to improve things through economic incentives, new policies that think in that sort of way. And I became interested, much as, you know, I think there's a lot in all of that, tremendously important. But I became interested in how, despite winning those economic arguments, you know, post the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, after which time even the left was having to accept that, you know, profit was a good idea. We had New Labour in the UK. There was Bill Clinton in the US. It was a real sort of change there. But despite winning those economic arguments, and indeed continuing to be somewhat popular politically, and Donald Trump in the US and Boris Johnson, particularly in the UK, becoming prime minister just last year with a huge majority. But despite all of those successes, at a cultural level, the culture seemed to be shifting to the left quite significantly, and particularly at the highest levels, the most sort of highly educated people. And I was interested in what was going on there, and it seemed to be much more cultural and so rather than economic. And so this book is an attempt to offer a kind of history of how that happened and some of the forces that were at work underneath the surface.
Right, right. I also notice in your about section on your website that you also are content director of Progressive Media, or you were content director of the Progressive Media International magazine. Is that a liberal or left?
That was a fascinating group? Conglomeration of magazines. So they were bought by someone who made his money in business information. So I think he sold a database company for $500 million or something like that. And when you do that, you can do whatever you like. And he saw a bunch of magazines he thought were interesting that didn't have any particular relation to one another, and he bought them all. And then he needed someone who knew about magazines and content, so I ended up working on them. But this was a stable of magazines that included The New Statesman, which I mentioned in my book. You know, it's the house journal of the intellectual left in the UK, has a very grand, long history going back to the early days of the sort of Fabians and the Labour Party, alongside Spears Wealth Management, which is a magazine for the ultra wealthy in Britain and sort of their lifestyle. So there's sort of utterly opposed magazines, and others that were luxury magazines on wine and for private jets and so forth. So it was a curious mix of magazines, to say the least. But interesting to work on and see that range. And actually, I got on tremendously well with the editor of the New Statesman, despite our political differences, which is always cheering.
Yes. And I wonder if because it's something that people have commented on and noticed, and I certainly have, you know, how sometimes, you know, the richest people in the world are also, you know, leaders of this wokeness and march to the institutions. I don't know if you got any insight into that through here, because it does seem like what is, you know, paradoxical, you know, billionaires fighting for social justice. I mean, you kind of see it in that mix you just described.
No, very true, very true. And I think the man who bought the magazines was sort of that way inclined. Not so much the ultra high net worth people who read Spears magazine or traveled on the private jets. I have to say, there's still some rich people who are just, you know, conventionally rich and splashing the cash. There's certainly a strain there, and perhaps a strain of people who are born into relatively wealthy families who haven't maybe, you know, made it in the same way themselves, who are less sort of practically committed to how money is made, particularly vulnerable to this, perhaps.
Yeah. And since this is an overtly political book, well, let me ask you straight up, right up front. Mm. I mean, how do you identify yourself politically? Because, you know, a lot of people like to, you know, be very simplistic about this, but I think you probably have a bit more of a nuanced position.
Yeah, I think so. I it might be easy to try and dismiss me as some sort of, I don't know, right-wing extremist or something like that. I see myself as broadly libertarian. I'm socially liberal and fiscally conservative, I suppose. I think, you know, capitalism is how you make economies work for everybody and raise the standard of living and deal with poverty in important ways. But equally, I think people have the right to live their lives as they want to live their lives. And so I get concerned about our overmighty systems of control and planning that have very noble goals, but can actually make things worse in the process, or have side effects that are far worse than their intended goals.
Right, right. So let's get to your book then. The title. Well, what is the Long March Through the Institutions, and why is it important?
Right. So the Long March Through the Institutions is an idea that was, the phrase was coined by a German radical called Rudi Deutschke in 1967 in Germany. That's an important moment because this is just before the famous riots of 1968. A movement of the New Left, as it was called, had been growing at this time, particularly in Europe. This was a kind of Western leftism that was really in reaction against some of the worst atrocities of Soviet communism. They saw things there they didn't like, but they were still trying to hold on to ideas of the left, very idealistic, but still revolutionary, committed to the idea that it wasn't about improving Western society. It was about fundamentally transforming it and putting something better in its place. And the more that the new left became concerned with revolution, it sort of split in two ways. There was one extreme wing that became committed to violent overthrow. And the famous example of that is the Baader-Meinhof gang, the Red Army faction, as they called themselves, which survived for quite a long time and was literally in the business of murdering people, of bombing people, of kidnappings, that kind of thing. They just thought there was no other way to do what they wanted to do and bring down Western society and put a sort of socialist, communist alternative in its place. That even in the UK, there were sort of small versions of that, something called the Angry Brigade. It was never a huge thing. Rudi Deutschke was offering an alternative to that. It's important to note he was still a revolutionary. He still wanted to destroy Western society, but he just thought there might be an alternative to violence. And so what he proposed instead was the Long March. This is a metaphor taken from Mao's campaigns, Chairman Mao's campaigns in China. And what he was suggesting was a long and quiet revolution where instead of violent overthrow of the society, you would do an end run around politics by putting your people slowly and steadily into all the institutions of the culture so that the universities, the schools, the churches, bureaucracies, whatever, would have people who thought like you did in these positions of power, and that then that would create such change that it would be possible to actually get the revolution that you wanted without having to fire a shot. And he was drawing on older ideas that came particularly from an Italian communist called Antonio Gramsci. And this was just in Germany, but it was taken up as well by a very important figure in the New Left in America called Herbert Marcuse, who had come over. He was a refugee from Germany because of the war. And he wrote to Deutschke and talked about how much he agreed with him. And he was, at the time, extremely famous in the US, a major cultural figure. And he really embraced this idea as well, that instead of the violence, you would take over the society through taking over its institutions.
Right. And it's interesting in your prefatory remarks in the book, you note that there are basically two opposing views on this. There's one group of people who think that this is absolutely obvious that we are the victims of a Gramscian plot. And there are some other people who see it as, oh, this is just another right-wing conspiracy, and that there is no cultural Marxist takeover of Western civilization. And they have their sort of remarks against it. You've said that you recognize that there are these two very disparate views of the situation, and so I suppose you're trying to convince one camp, and on the other hand, for the people who are already convinced, and I would count myself among them, and we can talk about that later because I think you have an interesting history. You present a complex history, and you talk about how you reveal in the book a more surprising pattern of causation, and offer unexpected grounds for hope. Can you elaborate on this for us?
Sure, thank you. Yeah. I suppose what I'm trying to do really is disappoint both sides of that argument, but in interesting and surprising ways, I hope, that are still worth reading. There is a very conspiratorial version of this history, which is conspiratorial nonsense, and this is not a conspiratorial book. What I'm trying to do is to look at what people really thought, what really happened, and where we really are in ways that are very clear and measurable in some ways to see, and to explain how we got there. This isn't a book that says, ha, there were a few Marxists twirling their moustaches and they all went into, and it happened by some cunning plan. The real world doesn't work like that. And in fact, you know, I talk that there are very real campaigns of subversion going on in the West throughout the 20th century, starting with Russia and coming all the way through. Certainly people who are inspired by Deutschke and Marcuse and things like that. But most of what happened, as so often in life, is about cock up as much as conspiracy. It's about coincidence and just the ways things happen. I think it's undeniable that what happened is that there was, coming out of the 60s, after this sort of 1967-68 period where these ideas were floating around, you saw a tremendous shift of power in unelected places within our societies. And so to see this in measurable terms, Thomas Piketty, who's you know, certainly not a right-winger, famous for his book Capital, arguing for wealth taxes, did a very important paper which looked across several countries. You know, it's not a UK thing, UK, US, France, I believe, probably those were the main ones, and just looking at political views in different economic classes. And basically over the last, let's say, 20 years or so, he sees a very measurable, very distinct shift to the left in the educated classes. So he calls it the Brahmin left. This is basically the university-going classes just shifted their views that way in a very measurable, very distinct fashion, happening across multiple countries. And he doesn't particularly get into why. He offers some possibilities. But I just think it's important to note that there are very, very concrete ways that you can look at it and say, well, look, something seems to have happened. And whatever your views on that, it's important to acknowledge that. Also important, I think, for people on the left to acknowledge whether they, you know, believe in something like a long march or not, that a tremendous number of quite influential people do. This isn't a fringe matter. As I talk about in the first chapter of the book, what happened after the election in the UK, where Boris Johnson won an enormous majority, 80-seat majority, which is, you know, it's enough to mean his party's probably in power for 10 years. It's a huge success. And yet immediately afterwards, a lot of the senior conservatives were writing in the national papers saying, well, you know, the trouble is we have lost the culture, we don't have the institutions, citing Antonio Gramsci, who I mentioned by name, and saying that, you know, we've won this political battle, but Gramsci's disciples have won a different one, and they're really very downbeat on that. So these things are affecting the debate at a very high level in the UK, and I'm sure elsewhere too. So I think it's important for people to understand what they are and to take them into account, even if they don't want to go all the way with the idea that a long march was sort of actively campaigned.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, I'd like I suspect you're probably younger than me. I started university in the 80s when Reagan and Thatcher were big, right? So I'm suspecting I'm probably a little older.
Maybe a little. Or
yeah, right. And so it, at that time, and I went to university and school and high school in Canada, in Toronto, where the culture is, you know, the sort of a natural party of government are the liberals, right? So it's a very sort of liberal environment. But at the universities, you know, the neoliberal document and what today we would call the neoconservative, kind of like the you know, the Cold War warriors, one were very, very influential and big in the academy. And I remember, you know, at that time I was actually very much on the left and anti-imperialist and pro-third world and whatnot. Now the anthropology classes I took, that's where we got a lot of the subversive theories from. Gramsci was concentrated a lot on Foucault was kind of a new thing, but still at that time coming up, and so, you know, so we were looking at these sorts of things, and it was really, you know, we definitely had the idea, and I think it was true that it was, you know, you know, subversive, you know, a minority view struggling against a sort of dominant, you know, Reagan Thatcherite view in the universities. And it's amazing how, you know, that's totally, totally changed in the universities over the years, you know, but on the other hand, another thing, by growing up in Toronto, I've given this story before. The idea we had as is very much along Pinketty's idea of the Brahmin class you're talking about, you know. So if you were educated and smart and humane, you were naturally a liberal. Conservatives were stupid. They didn't read the you know, the intellectual papers. They were, you know, just sports fans. They were selfish, and that was your idea of a conservative. You know, kind of an oaf, a selfish person who didn't understand the world. And if you were sophisticated and well-read, well, you were naturally a liberal. When I went and I did my PhD in the UK, and I met a whole bunch of people, like Noel O'Sullivan was in my department there, and other people, Lord Norton of Louth. And it was amazing. This whole world of intellectual European conservatives was shut off my whole life. And I was so angry at the education I had before, because there were such exciting ideas that I had never been exposed to. And this all speaks to the kind of culture wars and the march to the institutions that you talk about. I'd like you to sort of shed your insight on that little story I told of my own experience with the university system.
That's a great story. Thank you for that, Kirk. Yeah, I mean, one of the important things that happens when institutions shift to one particular point of view, and this is important to understand, because people can look at this and be very skeptical, because they'll say, well, look, you know, we're smart people. We're not indoctrinated. People tell us their political views. It doesn't mean that we're won over by them. Well, fine, but two things happen when you get university schools, et cetera, with a view that tilts just one way and that they're sharing. One idea is what you're talking about. You don't hear the other side. You forget the other side exists. The idea that there's an intellectual way to be conservative just becomes something that's not even possible to think about. So people miss out on a whole raft of ideas, and that's obviously very important. Then they can't think those thoughts. It closes the mind down in certain ways. And the other thing, which is slightly more subtle and pernicious, and I talk about quite a lot in the book, is the way that it teaches you, even if you don't agree, what's fashionable to think and what's acceptable to say. So there's an economist called Timur Kuran, who I cite in the book, and he has this whole theory that he worked out, which he studied a lot Eastern Europe under communism, where people had to watch what they said very, very carefully because of secret police, etc., etc. And so he thinks about the idea of, you know, what's the thing that you can say in public and what's the thing you think in private and how different they are. And what happens when universities are saying, well, this is what you have to believe, or this is what we believe, this is what is going to get you high marks, this is what is going to earn you a sophisticated place in society. So even if you don't agree, even if you aren't won over, you start to know, well, that's what I have to say to get on. And it changes what you think that you can actually say in public. So even if there isn't an indoctrination, there can still be these very chilling effects where even if you still have differing views, you find that it's increasingly impossible to say them because of the social pressures.
Yeah, absolutely. Now these culture wars, as you note in your book itself, that, you know, it's been going on a long time. I mean, I remember in the 90s, you know, where, you know, it reached, well, the late 80s, and then in the 90s it reached a head. And to me, it seemed to me that everything sort of settled by the late 90s, and that was it. And then I suppose then we went into the whole war on terror and all that stuff by the 2000s. But you mentioned in your acknowledgement and preface that when you were beginning research for this book, there was a Battle of Ideas charity that hosted its academy on culture wars then and now, and that this provided and impetus for this book, if I'm not mistaken. Could you just sort of touch on that and how what you're writing about now fits into this, you know, picture? It seems like a sort of pendulum sometimes going from, you know, one side to the next, back and forth. I'd like to hear your insights on that.
Yeah, sure. No, that was a great conference. And to sort of add to my bona fides as someone who's willing to listen to all sorts of sides, that's actually a conference run at the Institute of Ideas. Battle of Ideas people are ex-revolutionary Marxists who haven't exactly seen the light. Either they'd certainly consider themselves to be of the left, but they're open to other ideas these days, and certainly very concerned about issues like this. And so they don't come from exactly the same political place as me, but you can have a very interesting conversation with them. They're very sophisticated thinkers, and this was a great array of panels and speakers trying to put, yes, the culture wars into a very long duration, and you can sort of see how it happens. Something that you see when you look at that length of time is how much state power matters. And this goes to the whole heart of things, is because sometimes conservatives look at this sort of problem and they say, well, you know, the answer is we just need to win for our side, or we need to take over these institutions for ourselves, or we need to legislate for our kind of values. But the problem with that is that that just pours more power into the center, and the other side is going to win at some point. And it seems from the ability of the left to win institutional power that that's actually going to happen more rather than not to their side. And you're creating a problem for the future that you aren't even realizing yet, which is why I stress answers that are more about removing power away from the center and the state, where to in a more sort of diverse and lower level kind of solution. And a historical example of that is what happened with schooling in the UK. So it's 1860, I think, thereabouts, is when it became compulsory. But there was a lot of schooling going on already. And it became a kind of a culture war, where the people who were going and inspecting these schools that were, you know, outside the purview of the state and just parents educating their children and paying some money to do it, they were concerned that there wasn't proper religious education going on at the schools. You know, they weren't getting the moral instruction that was suitable for the fibre of the nation. So it was really a kind of a conservative culture war that then helped to provide the impetus for putting the state into education and controlling across the country what it was going to be like. So you're starting to shape that, because it's a way of shaping moral character. And so that was a conservative cultural war victory, if you like. But as it has turned out, I think it's very clear that state education system in the UK is an incredibly powerful, very left-dominated means for this kind of cultural education. The number of people in the education sector in the UK who vote conservative, you know, vote for the sort of right-wing party, is something like 10%, is barely even 10%, whereas it's maybe 40% or so who acknowledge that they vote for the left-wing party, for the Labour Party. So these are huge discrepancies. It's a very, very leftist part of our society. And ironically, the reason it has power is because conservatives way back a long time ago thought, oh, this is fine. We'll just take power of this and use it to get what we want, not realizing over the long term that you're actually giving something that your enemy can use.
Yeah. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. Now, if we go through this, the story that you outline in the book, I suppose there are key questions I'd like you to answer in sort of going through the story, you know, like, you know, how did it happen? You know, when would you say it started? You know, were there key moments? You know, what's the end game? What's the main goal? Is it the destruction of Western civilization or a Marxist leftist takeover, or you know, and who are the sort of main actors? You know, if you were to sort of outline the story quickly, you know, touching on those points, how would you do so for us?
Sure. Let's it's not a small canvas, but we'll do what we can.
Right.
So this is really a story about disappointment in revolution in the West. Mm-hmm. Plenty of communist and socialist thinkers around in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and they've got Marx, and they have this theory, and they think it makes a lot of sense, and they look at these societies in the West, these industrial societies, and they think, well, these are just rotten to the core. There's all these exploited workers at the bottom. There's going to be a revolution. Marx is right. But then the society that has the revolution is the agrarian serf society of Imperial Russia, and that's not what anyone was expecting at all. And, okay, that gives a victory, you know, a communist state, but that's not what they were expecting. They don't know why revolution isn't happening where it's supposed to be happening, in these industrial heartlands. And this has constantly been the problem for the revolutionaries, is that the proletariat, the poor people that they're supposed to be having the revolution on behalf of, it never really wins their hearts, which is partly why you end up, you know, with these rich people and educated classes being the ones who are taken by these ideas, but not the people at the bottom of society. But in any case, they're looking at these societies and they can't work out why it isn't happening. So what you start to get are people developing more sort of Western ideas of how to bring about a revolution. Since they're being disappointed just by the arc of history, doesn't seem to be turning their way. And after World War One in particular, which is sort of that total catastrophe for the, you know, the settled society of Western powers like Britain, you know, it's sort of real disaster for that sort of aristocratic world. You might think then it was going to happen then, but it still hadn't happened. And also in this sort of early 20th century, you start to have a rival totalitarian force coming in with the rise of fascism, which the communists are totally opposed to as well. I mean, obviously, because it wants the power that they want, but also because their values they see as very different. And Antonio Gramsci, who we've mentioned a couple of times, was in fact locked up by Mussolini because he thought he was so dangerous. So they're very concerned about the rise of fascism. They see that as really what these industrial societies are all about, that's sort of what they stand for. And they're trying to come up with an alternative. And what they... Gramsci and others, particularly something called the Frankfurt School in Germany again, but it moves to America as these ideas tended to then grow and really spread. But what they're interested in is what's sometimes very loosely called cultural Marxism or perhaps Western Marxism, a Marxism that thinks about not solving everything economically, that just the economic contradictions will destroy the society, but that you will look at the cultural frame and that the culture of the society, you know, the churches, the schools, the universities, the sort of things we've been talking about, that sets the frame in which it's possible or impossible to imagine a different world. And if you can change the culture, all these institutions that together produce the sort of the refusal to see the need for revolution, then you will finally get the revolution that you want. So that's very broadly the idea that they come up with. And in various forms, that's what's informs these other things. Because really, Deutschke in 1967 in Germany, and then Herbert Marcuse and the New Left in across Europe and also in America as well. And in America, again, this idea, this sort of fear of fascism takes on a slightly strange new form in that it continues. Because, I mean, America was fighting the fascists at this point, of course, but to Marcuse and others, the bourgeois society there was itself incipient fascism. They genuinely thought, I don't think they were doing this for effect, they genuinely thought that they were, you know, one bad leader, one bad moment away from a Hitler in America. So that was driving the very real horror they had of that society. And, you know, it's sometimes you could sentimentalize them and say, well, these people were just, you know, they were just hoping for a better world. They really weren't. They thought the ordinary American was basically a Nazi in waiting. Right. Herbert Marcuse is something I quote in the book where he writes an essay saying, oh, well, you know, we don't believe in violence. We don't believe in violence at all. No, that's not the way to get the revolution. We still want the revolution. And all these ordinary people in America are obviously as guilty as Hitler and Himmler. They're just as bad. But we just don't kill them because that's just not what we do. I mean, it's important to understand exactly how radical their thought was. But where I think I differ from some of the sort of more paranoid theories of this is to say, well, it's true that these people came along with these views which saw Western society as corrupt, wanted it completely overthrown, and that thought that you did that through these cultural means. And they spread these ideas and variations of them broadly through universities and so on. But it wasn't so much that there was an organized campaign to go into the institutions and make that happen, and you'll go there and I'll send you off to the schools. There was nothing like that going off. There was some people who tried to do that kind of thing. There's a very well-documented case at a polytechnic in North London where it was very, very unpleasant, very sort of not violent, but lots of intimidation and shouting and manipulation in order to take over an institution of higher education for these sort of radical politics. But that sort of thing tends to be noticed as there and doesn't necessarily work that well. So it wasn't so much about that kind of infiltration, but just the general spread of these ideas that were very sceptical about the society they were living in and that thought that it was important to look at institutions and to broadly shift them in these sort of leftward directions. And just to jump a little bit, but one of the things that I found very interesting really was how much what happened recently mattered in a way I thought it might not have. So at the end of the Cold War, so, you know, 89, early 90s, when really the economic arguments had been won and so Tony Blair, New Labour in the UK, was saying, well, you know, he won a massive majority and he was the new kind of left leader who believed in capitalism and said, you can get stinking rich, just pay your taxes. But he was still very interested in state power and helping people through this sort of central control, but not worried about those economic outcomes in the same way, not looking for revolution. But at the same time, And you might think, everyone thought, certainly on the free market, right, well, this is great. This is a victory for us. This is our kind of leftism. You know, we can go with this. But when you stand back and look at it, what happened over the period in which he was in power and really ever since, is what he did was he placed people that he agreed with very widely into lots of powerful unelected positions. We call them quangos, administrative bureaucratic positions where you have quite a lot of influence through various sort of committees and panels over how the country works.
Right. For US listeners who might not be familiar with the term, it's quasi-NGOs, correct?
Quasi-autonomous non-governmental organizations.
Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. That's right.
So non-revolutionary signed up to the sort of capitalist arguments for the economy, but on the side, putting a lot of sort of left-leaning people, and again, not radical revolutionaries, into all of these positions. And that didn't seem maybe so much at the time, but now looking back, that has had an enormous shift in the thinking across the UK. And it means that although we have a massive conservative majority in the House of Commons, you know, in our government, the country voted for conservative administration, that can do nothing about all these left-leaning people who have been placed in all these other positions. And then they create a sort of interlocking system of informal resistance against any conservative reforms that the government tries to make. So it's really hamstrung what politics can do in the UK in really quite surprising ways. And it's not the long march as such that people like Rudi Dutschke wanted, but it has remarkably powerful effects.
Yes, and I mean, this is part of your argument, and I think part of the surprise and twists you talk about, that I don't think, if I understand your argument correctly, I don't think you're saying that, well, okay, now the radical left has won and their plans have now been achieved. You speak about, the blob, and, not necessarily communists or socialists, and, the political class, a quangocracy kind of, if I'm not mistaken. Could you elaborate on that for us? Describe this blob, this political class who appears to be the victor in all of this.
Yeah, the blob is a great phrase. It's it chimes off the old sci-fi movie about a sort of faceless monster that sort of consumes everything in its path, and you can't fight because it doesn't really have a body or a face. And it was originally used to describe the problem of education reform in the United States. And then it was picked up in the United Kingdom as well, because infamously, education reform is very, very difficult because there's a lot of interlocking organizations who support each other and tend to think the same way. So if you try and bring in an idea, they'll defend each other, and it's sort of like trying to fight fog. So that's where it comes from. And then in the UK, people started to expand how they used it to describe what was a growing problem in the sort of post-Blair years, where there seemed to be something that you couldn't quite put your finger on. There were just organizations who no one had officially got them to coordinate together, and no one had really elected anyone to them. But nonetheless, they had all this power and they supported each other. And it was an enormous sort of influential effect. And that class of people, as you say, are perhaps best described as managerialists. Their politics are left liberal. They're not themselves revolutionaries. But their problem is they're, as managerialists, they're very sort of self-interested, very careerist, very focused on self-presentation and on these sort of positive social goals that they think are really what their organization should be for, with this sort of left-leaning aspect that they have. And that makes them dangerously uninterested in what their organizations are actually there to do. And as a result, they become quite bad at what they have to do. And one of the problems that we have in the UK at the moment is a sort of startling array of organizations that seem to be very concerned about climate change and diversity, or whatever the green issues, whatever the latest fashionable ism is, but not necessarily in what they should be doing themselves. So the Church of England is much more concerned about bringing forward its carbon emissions targets than it is about the fact that it doesn't have enough people who actually go to church anymore. Or the National Trust, which is our organisation which looks after grand old houses, is now saying, well, we're going to move away from the mansion experience in which we focus on grand old houses. And you think, well, isn't that kind of what you're for? And yes. Particularly, to think about sort of more practical organizations. With the pandemic, I think you know, it's been fairly clear within the UK and for anyone perhaps looking at the UK from outside that our organisations that should be able to manage a situation like that, and which in some ways you would think would be world class, are embarrassingly poor, particularly Public Health England, which was our quango that was specifically concerned with issues like testing for COVID-19, and has just had to be dismantled because it was just completely dysfunctional. So one problem has happened with this infiltration by a managerial left liberal class, is that they're just bad at their jobs and therefore bad at running these organisations in ways that actually matter to everyone else in society.
Yeah, I think that's a good and important insight, and it does match up with my observations and going through some of these swings, because I've kind of noticed that, you know, even when the institutions had this sort of right wing bias, and now they have this kind of left wing bias, there's this group of conformists and group thinkers and social climbers and bureaucrats that will say and do whatever is popular to be at the top. So if today it's anti-racism, they're the number one anti-racists. And if tomorrow it's anti-communists, they're the biggest anti-communists. And it's sort of this, they're just mouthing, whatever platitudes of the day are going to get them ahead. And I think that's kind of something which you are pointing to here. Am I right or not?
Yeah. Yes. No. I think that's right. So there's a lot of discussion going on in the UK at the moment, post Black Lives Matters, about tearing down assorted statues from Winston Churchill to slaveholders to all kinds of things, including statues in churches. Now, obviously, there are huge issues around historic oppression and so forth. And I don't want to belittle any of that, but there's just something striking about the people who run, councils, and London, for example, the Mayor of London is doing this, who are seizing on this, not so much, I think, because they care remotely about how effective this is, but because they know that it looks good and it burnishes their credentials on a fashionable, newly fashionable issue. And meanwhile, there is a cost to that, because there are real problems, not just a massive global pandemic, but I mean, in London, for example, really, really serious issues around knife crime, for example, that are not being dealt with. And it's not clear that these fashionable things, especially because when it's fashion, you move from one to the other very fast, that there's any interest in what sort of actual effective good you're doing and what good you're not doing because you're focusing on that, instead of some of the things that really matter.
Absolutely, yeah. It's kind of like about bureaucratic self-survival rather than completing a mission, And I see that definitely. One thing I want to ask you a little bit about that you touch on in your book is, we've spoken about Marcuse, we've spoken about Gramsci, Mao. I think Mao is extremely complicated in this whole question, because throughout his long career, he's had sort of different positions. Could you just elaborate your thinking and argument as regards to Mao and Maoism and this whole movement?
Sure. Well, I don't get into Mao a huge amount, but he's important because the Long March is effectively a reference to a particular military campaign of his. And that says something about the valorization of Mao among Western thinkers who were really seduced by these ideas, often seduced because the consequences of these ideas above communism were happening a very, very long way away. It was easier to say, I've got my copy of Mao's Little Red Book on a campus in the West, while whatever Mao might be getting up to with the Cultural Revolution, or what Stalin indeed was getting up to in Soviet Russia, was happening far, far away. Still today, one of the most senior figures in the Labour Party in the UK has said, and has never apologised for saying on British television that she thought Mao did more good than bad. This is a man who killed millions of people. And the crimes of communism in Soviet Russia, in China, in Pol Pot's Cambodia, around the world, still don't get the attention that they deserve. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to hold on to that. And that, I think, is partly a hangover still of having the children of the 60s, the people who grew up, you know, with a copy of Mao's Little Red Book, or thinking, well, now this is the way to build a better world, that they just, they don't really want to admit that what they were doing wasn't just a bit of fashionable fun, but was actually something that just killed people on a scale that is almost too vast to imagine. What I think at the moment is that it's important to think about that there was this beautiful, seductive philosophy in the 20th century, this idea that, you know, we could equalize economic outcomes for the whole of society through economic planning and control by the state, which is basically the idea, instead of focusing, say, on economic opportunity or something like that, but economic outcomes, equalizing those. That was lots of very, very smart people thought that was beautiful. And it took a very long time to win that argument. You know, like I say, not really until the 1990s. And meanwhile, millions upon millions of people died, mountains of corpses. Mm-hmm. Today, what we have is sort of new sort of cultural version of that same sort of theory, which again is a very seductive, very beautiful idea about seeking equal social and cultural outcomes. So we're not so worried in this about economic outcomes, but instead more like, have enough people of the right sort got this sort of job? Are they earning this much money? And seeing any disparities as necessarily proof of injustice, proof of something that needs to be fixed. And what we haven't, I think, realized yet, because people spent a long time arguing against the economic version of that argument. You know, there was lots of sophisticated arguments that ultimately won the day, but there aren't really arguments yet that understand that this is just as dangerous as the economic version of the argument, that if you're seeking to equalize outcomes socially and culturally, that requires so much power in the center to people who are just can't manage it responsibly, that you are going to create a road to hell faster than you realize. And that's what worries me about these social and cultural movements now, that really they're actually just a parallel form to the one that we spent decades defeating, but that because we focused on the economic arguments, we didn't have the same arguments against this sort of social cultural form of the same thing. And it's going to take a while to learn how to counter that.
You mentioned quite rightly the Gramscian notion of, you know, the war of position and the sort of establishing a different hegemony and fighting the cultural bourgeois hegemony. And it seems to me very much that we are in a phase of a Maoist cultural revolution now, that we've sort of gone past the Gramscian quiet, peaceful phase and tearing down statues and destroying people's personal lives. And just like the Gang of Four and the cultural revolutionaries were doing in 1966. And just, you know, as I was just refreshing my mind about this, I saw that, The Cultural Revolution had this aim of destroying the four olds. And these are the old customs, the old culture, the old habits, and old ideas. That sounds eerily familiar today. It sounds, absolutely contemporary. Do you have any comments you want to make on that?
Oh, I think it's chilling. If you go and look at some of the records of struggle sessions, which was going on in the Cultural Revolution of Maoist China, where you see, you know, the young students hectoring the old, the educated, the bourgeois, humiliating them, forcing them to sort of recant for not being righteous enough in the revolution. And horrible in itself, but horrible too, because it chimes very much with where we are now, which is really what I was trying to say about how these, you know, this search for equality of sort of social and cultural outcomes, this sort of new revolutionary fervor is sending people in very, very dangerous directions. It's not clear to me where that ends, but it doesn't seem that it ends with anything like a free society, because suddenly you're in a world where anything you say that may be nothing to do with your job, whatever, can get you fired and is seen that that's the right thing to do, where speech becomes not the alternative to violence, you know, the act of persuasion that we have in a free society so we can debate things, but becomes something you can't use because it's violent itself, because it could hurt people. Once you've said that speech is violence and you're going to therefore have to regulate it as much as you do violence and control it, then what's left of the society where you can actually debate? You're in a world where the young, the woke, who've been to the right university courses are suddenly empowered to lecture and humiliate the people who are just too old to get it. That seems like a terrifying situation. And one thing that I say in the book, which I think is an important starting point for anyone trying to think through about, you know, what they might do about all of this, is that I think they should start by accepting that the right has effectively lost the culture war, that it is in a subservient position, it is in the position of someone who's been vanquished. If you start imagining that you're equals and you're just fighting like it's another election where there are two sides and anyone could win, it's really not like that anymore. The territory of the institutions is in other hands. And that means that even the institutions of the right can't necessarily act in a particularly robust manner to defend even their closest friends. And the example I quote in the book is Sir Roger Scruton, who was a remarkable man and a very sophisticated philosopher, very conservative philosopher. You were talking earlier about, you know, how hard it was when you were in Canada to encounter, you know, this sort of the intellectual conservative mind, what that experience was actually like. But, you know, he was sort of the pinnacle of that in many ways in the British scene. And he was hired for a minor administrative job in one of these UK quangos, which is sort of a very rare thing for a conservative to be given that sort of post. And then The New Statesman, which funnily enough I used to work with, published an interview which was basically a hit piece on him. It was used to paint him falsely as a bigot and a racist and all of these unacceptable things. And the interesting thing about that is not so much that the left went for him, of course they did, and of course they felt that they had the power to do it, but that the Conservative Party immediately folded, said, well, he's nothing to do with us, we disavow him, and fired him. They ended up backtracking when they realised that they'd just been making fools of themselves. But it says something about where the culture is, that the Conservatives were more scared of the leftist mob that was coming for this very prestigious Conservative philosopher than for defending who should have been one of their closest allies.
Yes, yes. It's an important point you make, and yet, on the other hand, you have this observation that you say that the left is unelectable now, looking at the strong showing of the Conservative Party. And I'm not sure if you are talking about only in the UK or also in the United States as well, because the Biden and Harris ticket seems to be exciting at least the media commentators. You know, I don't know how much of that will reflect in the actual votes. We'll see what happens. The dominant narrative will not say that the left is unelectable. They really think that this time Trump has had it. We've heard that many times before, of course. I'd like you to elaborate on that point first, and then we'll take it from there. So when you talk about the left being unelectable right now, could you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, sure. So this does seem to be a sort of not just a UK thing, a cross-national thing, but the US is perhaps a special example, so I'll come back to that. But broadly, the right is better, it seems, at moving slightly left economically than the left is at moving slightly right in a sort of more cultural sense. So Boris Johnson has managed to capture, his majority relied on him capturing people who used to vote for the left, but are also quite patriotic. They're old-fashioned left. They're not these sort of strange new radical left out of the universities that they don't understand, the sort of struggle session kids who, you know, want to wag their fingers at them. So that's why they voted for Boris Johnson. So he succeeded in making his offer to them slightly more left-wing. He was going to give, you know, them slightly more state power and money their way. Whereas the left-wing party found it much harder to present itself as patriotic and sort of old-fashioned and uncomplicated. And that seems to be replicated in quite a few countries. It seems like that sort of shift is more easy for the right to do, and that means that the right is doing quite well electorally. The US is a complicated case. I think Trump is a sort of unique case in so many ways. Joe Biden is an attempt to present a Democratic Party that is rather like the voters that Boris Johnson won over, that he is the face of, you know, old-fashioned Democrats, you know, not the radical chic of, I don't know, AOC and the Squad, the sort of more socialist it girls of that's coming up on the inside track. So Joe Biden presents perhaps a version of leftism that's traditional enough and old enough that it might just work, and we'll have to see. But it's interesting that that's the face, even though he's really very, very old for the job. But they've had to go to that age to find someone who fits that sort of profile of the old-fashioned Democrat, whereas that's not so much maybe the ideas that are waiting in the wings. And we shall see whether the ability to have that face prevents the worry about the other ideas that might be lurking in the background from affecting how people vote.
Right. Now, you also mentioned in terms of the way that, you know, the conservatives, I suppose you'd put it, have to fight against this long march is a distinctive way. It's not merely to have a counter march from the right, and it's also not to sort of engage in its own type of its own version of the left liberal managerialism that has taken over. Do you want to expand on that a little for us?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think I said slightly earlier, I'm not saying that right wing people should say, oh, well, this is a great idea, we'll just take over institutions and run them our way. That's not the civilized game, because, as I say, what has actually happened here is that all these institutions are failing because they have been taken over by political goals that are not the goals that they exist for. You know, hospitals should be making people well, and police forces should be policing, and teachers should be teaching, and churches should be, you know, saving souls and not dealing with whatever the latest fashionable political nonsense is, or about sharing political views and helping people to know what they should really think, hosting struggle sessions. So what we're trying to, I think, get back to, for all of our sakes, is a society where politics doesn't infect everything. You know, where we can actually just have conversations without having to do purity tests on what we think about everything and then cancelling people because they don't have the right views. So I think it's very important that, you know, right-wing people, conservative people, don't just try and copy this tactic, which is very difficult. You have to try and fight something without just being its mirror image. And I really try and give some suggestions to Boris Johnson, I suppose, in the book, because I'm trying to suggest that politics, in a way, is the one lever that's left. If you don't own the institutions, but you can vote in a government with a conservative point of view, then what you need is for that government, when in power, to try and use its position and influence to try and shape the culture away from that kind of political polarization and relentless politicization of everything. And that's That's certainly my hope. I think there is a longer and more important intellectual game, which is about coming up with alternative ideas, arguments against these ways of thinking, in the same way that it took, you know, decades in the 20th century to develop ideas for capitalism from Milton Friedman and Hayek and people like them. We need the cultural equivalent of that, but that can take a very long time. And so maybe that's a sort of generational challenge. And in the short term, I think there's room for political attempts to try and redress this and shift things away from, you know, what I think is really quite a dangerous spiral away from the ability to have the conversations that keep, you know, civil society functioning.
Yeah, I think that's that seems to be the message of your book. It's probably a good place to end the interview, would you say?
Yeah, no, it's been a terrific run through it all, Kirk. Thanks very much. It's been a real pleasure to chat over the ideas.
Thanks. And can you tell me, you know, whether you're working on any projects right now and where our listeners can find you and your work?
Sure. Listeners can find me at my website, which is marksidwell.com. That's Mark with a C. That's probably the best place to find information about this book. I try and collect all the various interviews, and there's a little video of me reading the first chapter and links to the PDF and the ebook and so on. I'm on Twitter as well, at Mark Sidwell, though I'm not terribly active, but you could always reach out to me there. I've got a project I'm working on now, actually, which is the next book. It's always the next book, which I hope will be a little more forward-looking, having done this very much as a sort of history of how we got to where we are. I'm interested in, you know, what are the ideas that bring us together and take us forward. And I'm working on a book about common sense at the moment, the sort of intelligent person's guide to common sense, if you like, which I think it's quite an interesting one. Lots more meat there than you might think.
Excellent. No, I look forward to it. But thanks so much for this interview. It's been very informative and enjoyable.
My pleasure, Kirk. Thank you.
Once again, the book is The Long March, How the Left Won the Culture War and What to Do About It. And we've been speaking to the author, Mark Sidwell. Thanks for listening.